Today's conference is now being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Thank you, and you may begin.
Good morning. I'd like to welcome everyone to the January 2015 edition of the Charm Telecom. Just want to remind everyone out there that if you would like to mute your phone, you can either use its own native mute function or you can just press *6, and that should mute you. Today, we have the honor of presenting Dr. Candy Hansen, who is with the Planetary Space Sciences Institute, where she's a senior scientist. Dr. Hansen is from beautiful Southern California, born and raised. She got her bachelor's degree from Cal State Fullerton in physics and went on to UCLA, where she received her PhD. As I mentioned, she's currently at PSI. She used to be work here at JPL. She has plenty of duties. She's a co-investigator on the UVIS instrument, which is on the Cassini spacecraft at Saturn. She is served as a deputy principal investigator for the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter High-Rise instrument. And those are just sort of a few of the job titles that she's held, just a very few. Research interests, she's interested in outer planet atmospheres and sort of dynamic phenomena that happen in those atmospheres, plumes and plume activity, such as Enceladus, about which she's going to talk to us today. But she's also looked at plumes in other places, Triton, for example, Mars, and recently Europa. And she also has an interest in Mars seasonal polar caps. She's worked on a number of missions, such as Voyager, Cassini. She worked on Mars Polar Lander, which I believe failed to achieve its objectives, many of them. She's also currently on Juno and, as I mentioned, MRO, and she's here today to talk to us about the Cassini UVIS instrument investigations into the plumes of Enceladus. Excuse me, not Europa, Enceladus. So with that, Dr. Hansen, I'd like to invite you to begin your talk.
Okay, great. Thank you for that nice introduction, Sean. So I'm going to focus today on how we use the ultraviolet instrument on Cassini to investigate Enceladus's plume and kind of open the curtain to say, how do we know what we say we know? And so that'll be the theme. On slide 2, you can see the outline of my talk. I'll start with a really incredibly short review for anyone who has never dialed into a Charm Telecom on Enceladus before. And then the bulk of the time we'll spend going through ultraviolet observations that we make with the ultraviolet imaging spectrograph, or UVIS, and in particular plume composition, structure, variability. And the way I've kind of framed this whole talk is in the form of questions. I think that scientists are like kids. We never stop asking questions. And so one question always leads to another. And so you'll see that throughout the talk. And then I'll end up talking about some future observations and what we hope to learn. So slide 3 is the little mini review. Enceladus is one of Saturn's small icy moons. Its mean density puts it gives it a composition of, you know, some portion water, some portion rock. It has a radius of about 252 kilometers, so it's not really very big. And Voyager images showed us a geologically young surface. So that was a puzzle that Voyager left us with. Why the geologically young surface? And then it's also been known for quite a long time that Enceladus's orbit coincides with the thickest portion of Saturn's E-ring. So another question has always been, does Enceladus supply the E-ring? Slide 4, July 14th of 2005 was a really big day, red-letter day for the Cassini mission. We had our third flyby of Enceladus, but it was the flyby that gave us a very clear view of the South Pole. And the blue fractures that you see in the image towards the bottom there actually cross the south polar region of Enceladus. So it's a little bit tipped as seen from the spacecraft. The spacecraft is to the south a bit. And suddenly all this youthful geology started to make sense. Slide 5 shows the ice particles erupting from those tiger stripe fissures. And so we now know that Enceladus is a geologically active body. And in terms of terminology, when I say plume, I mean the big structure of gas and particles coming from the south polar region of Enceladus. And when I say jets, I'm talking about these more small collimated features. In this image, it's the ice particles that we're looking at. And so what I'm going to talk about today is how we use UVIS to study the plume. And basically, when I say that, I'm going to be talking about the gases in the plume and the jets, not the ice particles. So going on to slide 6, this is just a little mini review of ultraviolet light. You can see a diagram of the electromagnetic spectrum on the left, and the wavelengths that UVIS is sensitive to are shown in the little blue box. So we have, there's two channels that are shown here. I'll say more about this in a minute, but we have an extreme ultraviolet channel and a far ultraviolet channel. And you can see the wavelengths of light that we detect in those two channels. Now there's three things where ultraviolet light is really has a lot to contribute to the overall study. And so the first is that gases will absorb light at ultraviolet wavelengths. And which wavelengths the gases absorbed are unique to a particular gas. So if you can say where the absorption wavelengths are, that's quite diagnostic of the composition. Gases also emit light at ultraviolet wavelengths. And I won't say very much about this in this presentation, but that has also been one of the ways that we've studied Saturn's environment. And then thirdly, surfaces will reflect light at ultraviolet wavelengths, and how much they reflect is also can be diagnostic of things like grain sizes. I'm not going to really say anything else in this talk about that. Mostly I'm going to focus on the first bullet, the absorption. So how do we actually use that feature? Slide 7 shows that the most important observations we can make with our ultraviolet instrument is to look at stars passing behind the plume as seen from the spacecraft. And so that's what we call an occultation. And it can be a star, or we also use the sun. And so we use this data to determine the composition. We can also use it to look at the structure of the plume. Slide 8 is just a summary of how the characteristics of the UVIS instrument. So we have 4 separate channels on the ultraviolet imaging spectrograph. We actually only use 3 of them to study Enceladus's plume. So when we're looking at a star, when we have a stellar occultation to observe, we use the far ultraviolet channel. That channel is sensitive to the wavelength of light from 1115 to 1915 angstroms. And in the case of these observations, we bin it to 512 spectral elements. So between 1115 and 1915, we will get 512 data points. And it takes us 5 seconds of integration time to get a good spectrum. The high-speed photometer is sensitive to roughly the same wavelength range, but in this case, in this channel of the instrument, what we do is we sum over wavelengths. So we're just looking at the quantity of light, if you will, as a function of time. And because we're just looking at the signal of the ultraviolet light hitting the detector, we can have a much higher time resolution, as fine as 2 to 8 milliseconds. Now, for the solar occultation, we use our extreme ultraviolet channel of the instrument, and that one is sensitive to 550 to 1100 angstroms, and very similarly, we can get a 1024, 512 spectral elements. Now, we focus the light onto two windows, and so that becomes important, and I'll show you later in the presentation why. And we can also do one-second integrations because the sun is really a booming signal as seen from the spacecraft. Okay, so slide 9. This is an artist concept of now imagine yourself on the spacecraft looking at that star and these the gas in between. Again, we use the ultraviolet imaging spectrograph, the UVIS, to look at composition, mass flux, and the plume and the jet structure, and that's what I'm going to describe is how we do that. We've actually observed 4 stellar and 1 solar occultation to date. In 2005, in February actually, we watched Lambdas go behind Enceladus, but we saw nothing. No plume detection at all. And the reason was because the star passed by at equatorial latitude. In July, we hit the jackpot with Gamma Orionis. And then subsequent to that, in October of 2007, and October of 2011, we observed Zeta Orionis. In May of 2010, we watched the sun be occulted by the plume. So slide 10 shows the geometry of these occultations. The 2007 Zeta Orionis occultation, the 2010 occultation, in both cases, our source did not go behind Enceladus. It crossed in a kind of a horizontal cut through the plume. In the upper left, however, you see 2005. In this case, we made more of a diagonal cut, and the star actually passed behind Enceladus. So those are the different geometries that we have to work with. Okay, so slide 11. Question number 1, what is the composition of the plume? And when I say, oh, it's water vapor, and I say it ever so confidently, I'm now going to tell you how do we know what the composition is. So this is data. The box on the right shows the data from the Gamma Orionis observation. So this is a spectrum. The blue spectrum shows you the signal coming from the star Gamma Orionis when it's not behind anything and as a function of wavelength. The red shows what happens to that starlight when the star is behind the plume. And so you can see that there's less light coming through. That starlight is being attenuated, and it's being attenuated at some wavelengths and not others. So what is it? There's a gas there. How much is there? Slide 12 shows you how we figure this out. And so I'm going to walk you through step by step, but, you know, some people this will probably be, you know, piece of cake, and others don't worry, this is the hardest slide in the whole presentation. So in the left, I'm showing again, kind of small now, our two spectra, the blue being the unocculted star, what it looks like when there's no gas in the way, the red when it goes behind the plume. And so we have 512 data points, and what we do, the first step, is to divide the occulted data by the unocculted data. So occulted data we refer to as I. That's when the star is behind the plume. The unocculted data is I naught. That's when it's not behind the plume. And then, so when you plot I versus I naught, now you can really clearly see where the absorption features are. And so if there were no absorption features whatsoever, I'd have a nice straight line here at I over I naught equals 1. But I don't. And what you can see is that there are some narrow absorption features on the left-hand side and a kind of a broad absorption feature more to the center right. So what we do is we compare our spectra to various gases to look for where do we have a match in terms of where those absorption features fall. The red line shows you water vapor. And it's pretty clear that water vapor is absorbing at the same wavelengths that we see the signature of the starlight being attenuated. So, of course, our next question is, oh, okay, it's water. How much is there? So that's step four. We have an equation, I equals I naught e to the minus n times sigma. N is the column density, and sigma is the cross-section. So sigma is something that we measure in the laboratory. And these values are tabulated as a function of wavelength. And so you just can go to, there's libraries of this stuff. And that's how we know what where water likes to absorb. N is how much is there. And so we just vary N until we get a good match of the red spectrum to the blue. And after doing all of that, we can come up with what's called the column density, 1.6 times 10 to the 16 water molecules per square centimeter. So that just means how much water is in our line of sight. It's not, to get the third dimension, the actual density in the plume, you have to know some other things. Okay, so going to slide 13, everybody can breathe again. What's our next question? Okay, so now we know that there's water. We know how much is in our line of sight. How much water is coming from Enceladus? And so if you imagine the water flowing out of Enceladus and through this sort of square or a rectangular area, and it's got some sort of a velocity, then we can estimate how much water is crossing through that area as a function of time. And so we do that knowing the N that we just fit to our data, estimating H, and I'll say a little bit more about how we estimate that dimension. The velocity is probably the weakest link in the whole equation because we don't actually know the velocity of the gas, but we can estimate that if it has a temperature of 170 Kelvin, it should be moving at about 45,000 centimeters per second. And I will just note here that escape velocity is 23,000 centimeters per second. So it's clearly escaping from Enceladus even at that low of a temperature. And so doing the arithmetic, then we can estimate that about 170 kilograms per second of water is coming from Enceladus. Which brings us to our next question. Now we know how much there is. Is it enough to explain all the water products that we see in the Saturn system? So slide 14, what do I mean by water product, first of all? Well, if you take H2O and you break it up into pieces, you can have hydrogen. Hydrogen was detected by Voyager in the 1980s. You can have OH. Hubble Space Telescope saw OH in 1992. And you can have atomic oxygen. We imaged atomic oxygen with UVIS in 2004. And so what this diagram shows on this page is the Saturn system. That little white guy in the middle there is Saturn. And the different colors are different contours of how much oxygen we see. Now, in this particular data set, we're using the fact that atomic oxygen emits light at ultraviolet wavelengths. And so specifically, we're looking at 1,304 angstroms. And we could actually map out where the oxygen is in Saturn's system. We could see that there's a lot of it. And we can see that it kind of follows the contours of Enceladus's orbit. Now, we know that water products will be lost from the Saturn system by collisions. It'll dissociate. It'll get ionized. And so it has to be resupplied. And so we can estimate what those resupply rates are. You can see the numbers there at the bottom of the chart. And going to slide 15, we can say yes. So we know what the rate of water vapor is coming from Enceladus. Is it enough to explain all that atomic oxygen that we see? And the answer is yes. And so this sort of solves kind of a big mystery, because when we saw all those water products from Voyager and from Hubble and from Cassini, we didn't really have a good idea of where they were all coming from. And there were lots of theories, and none of them really showed that there could be enough water until we realized that Enceladus was sitting there spewing out water, and definitely plenty. Okay. But, of course, now we prompt ourselves to the next question. Well, is there anything else in that plume?
Yes. Excuse me just a second. Oh, this is Cliff DeLacy from American Canyon, California. What is causing the ionization of the water molecule? Is that gammas coming in?
Yeah, and it's Saturn's magnetosphere, the plasma in Saturn's own magnetosphere.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you.
Uh-huh. Were there any other questions? I'm just kind of like streaming along here. Okay, well, let me continue. So, looking at other constituents, slide 16, one of Cassini's other instruments reported detection of a species with an atomic mass of 28. And so some candidates are carbon monoxide, C2H4, N2. All of those would be atomic mass of 28. So we said, well, maybe UVIS can tell us the answer. So the diagram on the right here shows us looking at ethylene, C2H4. And so there's the data itself, the navy blue. The red spectrum now is water with C2H4. The sort of light blue is water by itself. And it turns out that water by itself is still a better match to the spectrum than water plus ethylene. And we can do the same sort of analysis with CO, and so we can put upper limits on those two gases and say, no, not really enough to explain this other detection. What about nitrogen? Slide 17, to see nitrogen, there's no features for nitrogen in the far ultraviolet that we can utilize. So we turn to the extreme ultraviolet, and there's a very nice nitrogen feature I'll show you in a minute. On slide 17, you can see the same kind of data. Now we're looking at the spectrum of the sun, of our sun, the blue, and what happens when the sun passes behind the plume. You get the red, and you can see the gases are, in fact, absorbing some sunlight. It turns out, going to slide 18, that really that's all water vapor doing that and not any nitrogen. on slide 18, you can see the top red line shows where the nitrogen feature should be, that absorption there. And if you look straight below it to the blue, which is our data, there is no absorption feature right there. And in fact, most of the absorption is due to water. Although there could be some other species, we don't know what they are, but we can rule out nitrogen. Okay, so going on to slide 19. Now I'm going to leave behind composition for a while, and I'm going to talk about the structure of the plume and what we've learned, because we have several cuts through the plume, and the question is, what do they tell us? And secondly, do we see jets of gas that might correlate to the jets of ice particles that can be detected in the images? So slide 20 shows the dust jets. These are ice particles. These are visible images. You can only see these particles when the jets are backlit. They're very, very tiny particles. And so the question that we asked ourselves is, are there also collimated gas jets that UVIS could detect? Can we correlate, if we do find collimated gas jets, can we correlate them to these dust ice particle jets? So looking at slide 21, and again, this is a repeat of an earlier slide, but just to remind you again, when we cut through the plume horizontally, the star doesn't go behind Enceladus, it only goes behind the plume. And the plume is essentially coming straight out of the South Pole, so that gives us that horizontal cut. On slide 22, this is one I haven't shown you before. This is the dual occultation. We actually were able to observe two of the three stars in Orion's belt in 2011. And so we watched Epsilon and Zeta Orionis go behind the plume at almost the same time. When we do these horizontal cuts, and now I'm on slide 23, we've got three different cuts now. You're basically looking, in the upper left, you can see we're basically looking through the gas at a star in a distance. And so if I take that track of the star across the South Pole and I draw a perpendicular line down to the surface of Enceladus, what I get is the ground track that's shown on the right. And so this is the territory that the star is cutting across. And so you can see that in 2007, relative to the fissures that go across Enceladus' South Pole, we got kind of a diagonal cut. In 2010, with the solar occultation, the red line, you can see that the cut across was almost perpendicular to the Tiger Stripe fissures. And in 2011, we went pretty much parallel to the Baghdad fissure. Slide 24 shows that, in fact, we do see gas jets. We use our high-speed photometer so that we can have adequate time resolution. So the diagram on the left shows our data from the high-speed photometer. When the star is not behind the plume, we are getting about 3.9 times 10 to the fourth counts per 0.2 seconds. So that's the data. And when the star goes behind the plume, you can see how the gas absorbs the ultraviolet light that we're sensitive to for the duration that the star is behind the plume. Now, the far ultraviolet spectra that I've been showing you correspond to 5-second integrations. And the little red bar and the little green bar shows that we would not get any kind of good resolution of the plume in our far ultraviolet data because the integration time is too long. But with the high-speed photometer, we can actually see at much higher time resolution the structure within the plume. So looking at slide 25, we can, in fact, we did statistical tests to make sure, you know, which of these dips we could actually trust. And from that, we were able to say, yeah, there's four believable features: Cairo, Alexandria, Baghdad, and Damascus. And these are the names of the tiger stripes, which, by the way, everything on Enceladus has to be named after a location in the, from the book The Arabian Nights. And so this really has nothing to do with politics and everything to do with literature. Anyway, so that's the tiger stripes. Those are the enhanced absorptions that we see where we have these gas jets. In our solar occultation data, slide 26, again, we did have a horizontal cut. In this case, here's the two windows that we have for our solar occultation port. They both are showing similar structures. So in this case, we sort of declare that these little wiggles are believable because they're repeated, and if they were shot noise, they'd be unlikely. It would be unlikely that you would see them in both windows. So here, again, we can correlate these dips with the features on the surface, with the fissures on the surface, I should say. And if you go to slide 27, now I'm looking at that ground track again, and the beginning of the occultation is labeled ingress, upper right on the ground track plot. To the left is the data itself as a function of time. And so you can see that as the sun moved into the plume, it started to be attenuated. And when it hits the Alexandria fissure is when we see the dip labeled A. Then moving along, the minimum altitude is pretty much between Alexandria and Cairo. And then dip B would be the Cairo jets getting into our line of sight. And then C and D are Baghdad, or, yeah, no, D is, yeah, C and D are Baghdad, E and F are Damascus. So with this data, which is a minute, this occultation lasted a minute, and so these dips last multiple seconds, and we have our temporal resolution is 1 second. From that, we can measure the actual full width half max of these individual dust jets. We know how high above the surface our ray to the star is, and so on slide 28, we can actually use those measurements to say, first of all, yes, we see the jets. Second of all, they are quite collimated. The width versus the height is actually fairly narrow, 10 kilometers versus 29, for example. And we can relate that to the velocities, and from that we can actually estimate the Mach number. And these collimated jets are supersonic with Mach numbers ranging from 5 to 8. So the two diagrams on this chart are models. They're just hypotheses, but our data is consistent with gas being accelerated in nozzles below the surface to supersonic speed. So although we cannot see below the surface, we can see what we see above the surface and use it to constrain models of what's going on where we can't see things. Going to slide 29 and looking at particle size and composition, the UVIS data is very complementary to the data that we are getting from Cassini's dust analyzer, the CDA. The CDA detects two discrete sizes of ice grains, coming from Enceladus' south pole. So it's not just a sort of a continuous distribution of sizes. It's really two particular sizes. They're very, very small particles, 2 microns in size, and they're almost pure ice. They're very salt-poor grains. And then there's also big particles, relatively big, in the sort of 6 to 10 micron category. And these are salt-rich, and those are found close to the surface. They're not moving at those high speeds, and they are essentially not leaving at escape velocity. They're basically falling back onto the surface. And so what we think is happening is that the high-speed gas jets that we see in the UVIS data are propelling these tiny little particles out into space with escape velocity. Moving to slide 30, this is what we call the Perrier Ocean Model. And so this is just a model. This is a hypothesis. But it kind of pulls together all of our data sets in a very nice way. And so the sort of tenets of this model is that that Enceladus has the subsurface ocean, and the ocean has dissolved gases in it, that you get cracking in the ice crust, which allows the dense liquid to rise. As it rises, the bubbles come out of solution, and they form these salt-rich aerosols. The gas and bubble and water mixture keeps moving up, and then when you get close to the surface, you have the gas being accelerated in the nozzle and the tiny ice pour particles condense in the nozzle. So that's our idea, our best working hypothesis at the moment. Slide 31, let me just stop and recap, and then I'll pause for questions again. So what have we learned from our occultation data? We know the composition. It's primarily water vapor. We've set some upper limits for some other possible constituents. We know how much is coming from Enceladus. I haven't shown you my range yet of 170 to 220, but it's about 200 kilograms per second. We can say that Enceladus has been erupting steadily for the past 7 years, and we can explain all the water products that we see. We've detected collimated jets that propel small ice particles out to become Saturn's E-ring. And slide 32, this is consistent with the model that I just showed you of the Perrier Ocean. But this is not the end of the story. So like I said, I'm just going to pause for a second here. So, you know, if you want to ask a question, if anybody has a question.
So I do have a question about this, Candy.
This is Cliff DeLacy again. My question is, the light that's attenuated by the plume from starlight, from a distant star, how much does that interfere with determining what the what that ionization causes, or either from gamma rays or from what's being ejected from Enceladus itself?
Oh, you know what? We are so close to Enceladus that the signal's completely dominated by the neutrals.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so we don't have to worry about that. It's really all we're seeing is the water vapor coming from Enceladus.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Hi, this is Adrienne Provenzano from Solar System Ambassadors. I'm really enjoying the presentation. My question has to do with the formation of the E-ring. So I'm wondering, is the thought, or is there a hypothesis that Enceladus has always been responsible for that formation, or it's just a more recent contributor?
Well, we've known about the E-ring for something like 50 years, so certainly the E-ring has been there that long, and there's no reason to think it hasn't been there, you know, much, much, much longer. And yeah, we're really quite certain now that Enceladus is the source of the E-ring. You know, when you can calculate how many particles are coming out and calculate the spread. And we've actually got images. I'm not saying a lot about the images because mostly my talk is about the ultraviolet data, but we can see little tendrils actually coming from Enceladus of these particles coming out of Enceladus and going into the E-ring. And we know from our data and from the dust analyzer data that these particles, the tiny ones, are moving at escape velocity. And the dust analyzer can determine things like particle size, even when it's far away from Enceladus. And the particle sizes match when we're in close to the tiny ones. So the little tiny particles in the E-ring are the same as the little tiny particles that we see coming out of Enceladus close up. And so, yeah, we're really quite certain that now that the E-ring is caused by all this water coming out of Enceladus.
That's really neat. So then as a quick follow-up question, is there any research being done on the connections between the other moons, any of the other moons and the other rings?
We don't actually see any kind of geological activity at the other moons, although we're actually searching at Dione. But the other ones, you know, the levels are low enough that you can come up with other reasons, like a process we call sputtering. But the E-ring we could never explain. There was just never enough, no matter how hard you sputtered.
Candy, this is Ron Hobbs in Seattle, Solar System Ambassador.
Yes.
Has anybody made any estimates of how big or how wide the plume conduits would have to be?
We have some data from one of our other instruments that suggests that the nozzles at the surface are about 9 meters. So not very big at all, really. But what's going on below the surface, whether that opens up into larger cracks or whatever, we don't know.
Would love to explore it. Thank you.
Yeah. John, did you have a question?
You know, I did, but I think in the interest of time, I'm going to save mine for the end of the talk.
Okay. Well, let me keep going then. So now let's move to slide 33. Asking another question. Well, a whole bunch of other questions. Why? Why is all this happening at Enceladus? Why not the other moons? And what is the energy source for all of this action? And could it be tidal energy? And if it's tidal energy, then we should see variability that depends on where Enceladus is in its orbit. So do we see variability in the rate of water that's spewing out of Enceladus, depending on where it is in its orbit? And the answer to that question is no, maybe, yes, maybe. So let me explain all my little question marks there. But first I want to take a tiny minute to do a sidebar on terminology. So Enceladus's orbit is slightly elliptical, and we describe where Enceladus is in its orbit by what's called the mean anomaly or the orbital longitude. And my little diagram on the right is for a planet in orbit around the sun, but it's the same kind of idea that when you have an elliptical orbit, the place that is closest to the main body is para. So in an orbit we talk about the periaps. If you're a planet going around the sun, it's perihelion. At Saturn, that would be perichrone. And that would be 0 degrees orbital longitude. Apochrone, or apoapse, or aphelion, is the point at which the satellite is furthest from the central body, and that would be 180 degrees. So when I talk about an orbital longitude of 180 or a mean anomaly of 180, I'm talking about when it's further away as opposed to zero when it's closest. And you can imagine that the stresses on that satellite will be different depending on where it is relative to the central body. So slide 34, back to thinking about the geometry of the star or the sun going behind the plume, we're going to go back to that flux calculation. And so slide 35, the left upper left shows the solar occultation, the sun unocculted, then it goes behind the plume, and then it comes out again, and we can estimate where the full width half max of that bite out is, and we can say what was the duration, and we know what our line of sight velocity is. So we can estimate the dimension of the plume. How wide is the plume? And that is 160 kilometers. For the Zeta Orionis occultation, similarly, and that's the lower right, that occultation lasted just 10 seconds. We know what our line of sight velocity was. We can calculate the width at 110 kilometers. Now, it's not surprising that these two values are quite different, because if you think about the tiger stripes and where the jets are coming out, it's not circular by any means. It's more of a sort of a box on the surface, sort of a rectangle. So slide 36, and here's my little Enceladus ball again, and my little area and the velocity of the molecules going crossing that area, and same little formula. But now I've got all of my occultations in one table. So you can see 2005, 2007, 2010, the two cuts in 2011 from the two stars. Remember that N is that column density. So this is a quantity that we measure from our data by fitting the absorption spectrum. It's got an uncertainty associated with it. Why is the dimension of one side of that area, and we can estimate that dimension from what I just took you through, the full width half max of the duration that you have that cutout in your signal. And so for 2007 and 10 and 11, we can come up with a number of kilometers that is a straightforward, it was cut out for this much time. In 2005, because it was more of a diagonal, that's more of an estimate. The velocity, again, is the complete wild guess, but we do use a consistent value across all of them to come up with our flux in kilograms per second. And you can see these numbers range from 170 to 220. And so from this data, you might conclude, well, the source rate hasn't really changed much in over 6 years. The deviation is less than 15%. It's certainly not factors of two. However, and you guys knew that however was coming, I'm sure, from the tone of my voice. Slide 37. This is data from the near-infrared spectrometer. So what you're looking at is the brightness of the light from the particles at high phase angles as a function across the bottom of where Enceladus was in its orbit when that data was collected. And so you can see that it's sort of flat, but then it suddenly has this peak in brightness that is right around 180 degrees. And it's a rather sharply peaked increase in brightness. And so, and it definitely, this curve definitely appears to have a dependence on where Enceladus is in its orbit. So, slide 38, we seem to have this big discrepancy. Because these results, to my mind, are quite compelling. So how do we explain this inconsistency between the UVIS data and the VIMS data? Well, we are going to have an opportunity in 2016 to figure this out. If you go to slide 39, This is just a recap of that table without the diagram. And now my column on the right shows the mean anomaly, in other words, the position of Enceladus in its orbit to compare to the VIMS data. And you can see the two sort of brownish-colored measurements of 170 and 180 kilograms per second were at mean anomalies of 98 and 117. The two blue values of 220 kilograms per second were at a mean anomaly of about 236, 237. We have an opportunity to observe another occultation in 2016 at 208, and just as a reminder, 180 is where VIM sees that factor of 3 enhancement in the brightness of the plume. So, comparing that now on slide 40, you can see that the two sort of brownish-colored diamonds are the two locations where we got values of 170 and 180 kilograms per second. The two blue diamonds don't have a real counterpart in the VIMS, but if that peak is coming down as dramatically as it went up, then you would not expect to see a big enhancement, although we do see 220 as opposed to 180, but again, not a factor of 2 by any means. The new occultation, however, at 208...
Can I ask a question? This is Brad from JPL.
Oh, hi, Brad.
Hey there. Aren't you? Well, you're comparing like transmitted light to reflected light.
We are.
In your two samples here, but doesn't UVIS also get reflected light at the same time as VIMS is doing its measurements? So, shouldn't you have some comparable data?
No, it's too. There's not enough. It's below our detection threshold in the,
okay,
in the reflected data.
So, isn't there somewhat of a problem in comparing the transmission to reflected light, especially considering the differences in wavelength?
Oh, yeah. We're looking at gases versus particles.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I just wanted to...
Yeah.
I saw that last night, and I thought maybe you were mixing apples and oranges.
No, no. No, we're definitely looking at apples and oranges.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah. So, slide 41... How did we get that occultation? Well, we didn't begin with. We had something close in 2000 in the reference trajectory, and that shows the diagram on the left. That was the star, and the little round guy is Enceladus, and you can see it was close, but it certainly wasn't going to go behind the plume. And so we went to the project and said, do you think we could maybe tweak the trajectory enough to move that star to where it will go behind the plume? And so the NAV team did a study and said, yeah, it can be done. It's going to cost some fuel, and it's going to disrupt. There's going to be ripples through the tour. And so we had to go to the project and say, you know, well, is it even worth it? And so slide 42 is basically a long story short of the case that we needed to make, that because there was a serious sort of disruption in other events in the tour, and there was the fuel that we were going to have to use to get this occultation. But the UVIS data does fill an important gap. It does definitely allow us to compare gas to particles, and it allows us to answer the question, does the gas behave like the particles? So when we get that data in 2016, will we see something like a factor of 2 more gas coming from Enceladus, which would say, yes, the gas production peaks just like the particle production peaks, or maybe not. So if you go to slide 43, What we're trying to fathom is what is changing below the surface. We cannot see below the surface, but we can get lots of data above the surface and from the stuff escaping from below the surface. And so whatever models we come up with, like the cartoon on the right, are going to have to be consistent with the data that we are able to collect. And so we pose the question, what is different at Perichrone versus Apochrone? If the gas production does not change like the ice production does, that gas to ice ratio is changing. What would cause that? If they're the same, if they both sort of behave the same, then what is that telling us about the nozzle diameter? What is that telling us about the temperature of the gas? And so when we do models, we have to test them against our data. And so this is another sort of key piece of data. And so slide 44 is us, you know, really looking forward in great anticipation. You know, I hate to wish my life away, but hey, March 2016 is going to be really, you know, an important data point for us. If we see an enhancement in the gas flow, that's going to motivate new models. If we don't see an enhancement of the gas flow, that's going to also constrain our models. So either way, it's another data point, and it's another important data point that the models will have to be tested against. And so my concluding slide goes back to, does Enceladus supply the E-ring? And for the person who asked me the question about that, this is, I think, a beautiful image that, in fact, shows the E-ring, and the little dark dot is Enceladus, and the bright feature close to Enceladus is the plume, and you can see the tendrils moving out away from Enceladus. And so, yeah, we answered that question, but, hey, a lot more questions remain. So let me thank you for your time and your attention. And I'll be happy to answer questions as long as you guys want to hang on the line.
So, Candy, I'd like to thank you for your time and for preparing this presentation for us. I think it was really great. I'm going to take the moderator's advantage here and pose a couple of questions to you first, and hopefully I'm sure we'll have more questions. But I've got two questions, one of which should be easy, one of which is maybe a little bit more complicated. So easy question first. The 2016 occultation, I noticed that's an Epsilon Orionis.
Yes.
Is that also going to be a double one with Zeta as well?
No, just Epsilon.
Ah, bummer. The two for the price of one is pretty cool. A little more complicated. So there's this whole idea of the Perrier Ocean, and one thing you didn't talk too much about is the fact that water doesn't tend to want to do what the Perrier Ocean model is saying it should. In other words, the water shouldn't, the denser water shouldn't want to just break through and spew out, which implies there's got to be something else in there to play with the density of it, to help make it more buoyant. At least that's what I would think.
Right, and I didn't say this, but the gas that we think is doing this is CO2.
Okay, so this is kind of where I'm going. You know, is it troubling to you that we don't see with UVIS
CO2?
Actually, we can't determine it? And you also didn't talk much about carbon monoxide.
So let me talk about CO2 first.
Okay.
CO2, we could see CO2 if there was something like, if the plume was like 10 or 20% CO2, because there are absorption features in the far ultraviolet from CO2. And we don't see them, but the fact is it takes a lot of CO2 for us to see them. And this is based on the cross-sections, which I didn't really want to go into because that's getting very complicated. But it's the same analysis we actually have. We should, on the other hand, see carbon monoxide because it also has features in the far ultraviolet, and it doesn't take a lot of CO to make those features be attenuated. So it's just a difference in how readily the gas absorbs those far ultraviolet wavelengths of light. CO absorbs them readily, and so we should see the absorption feature. CO2, not so much, so it would take more CO2. So I am not troubled by not seeing CO2 as that being inconsistent with this model.
So, but to be clear, you've modeled the carbon monoxide in the spectrum. You haven't seen it?
Right. That's
okay.
Right.
Are there other investigations on board the spacecraft that could, for example, detect these constituents once they've been ionized?
You know, I think probably CAPS, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much. Are there other questions out there?
Oh, let me just say one thing, though. There is a delay time. It takes a while for the gases to be ionized. So they remain neutrals for quite a distance leaving Enceladus. So whatever you measure, you know, out away from Enceladus, you have to then infer
that it came from there. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is Cliff Lacey again. At Terracone, don't you believe that you'd see more ice particles than you would at Apicon?
Well, you know, it depends. You have to remember, if you go back to one of my slides that showed, like, a ground track, these fissures are oriented in a very particular way. And so they are going to sort of open and close, if you will, depending on the stresses, in different ways as Enceladus goes around. So they're not perfectly aligned, if you know what I mean.
Yes, I understand that being closer to Saturn itself and coming around, then I would certainly think that the surface would spread a little bit from gravitational attraction on whether or not there's volcanic eruptions underneath.
Yeah, and so you have to take into account not only what the stresses are, but also what the orientation of the fissures is.
Yes, I understand.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Hi, this is Adrian Provenzano again, and thanks for pointing out how the slide towards the end shows the interaction between the relationship between Enceladus and the earring.
it's a beautiful picture.
Yeah, it is, and I love the one with the backlighting of the jets as well. That's a really stunning shot as well. So I'm wondering, is there any thought of using this approach to studying other icy moons and how they might be creating rings around something else?
So let me talk about Dione a little bit, because there is some data that suggests that there is material coming from Dione. And so we've been looking, we've been observing occultations of stars by Dione. And we've observed quite a few now. I want to say 8 or 10. And we haven't seen anything like what we see at Enceladus. Now, there are some reasons. One is that Dione is quite a bit bigger, so it has more mass, which means it has more gravity, which means that any material escaping is going to have a higher escape velocity. And so the plumes, if there are any, are going to be much smaller and closer to the surface. And so, in a sense, we have to get lucky if we're going to see something like this. But we've definitely been looking, because there is this hint from the magnetometer data, actually, that there is what we call mass loading near Dione. Now, they have the same data for the other moons, and they don't really see any hint of, you know, any kind of bulk of material coming from any of the other moons. Now, the Phoebe ring, which you may be thinking about, has an entirely different reason for being, and that has to do with things colliding and actually knocking stuff off the surface. So if you're interested in the Phoebe ring, there was a really incredibly good write-up that was done by Emily Lakdawalla of the Planetary Society. Mm-hmm. If you go to the Planetary Society page and you look for Emily Lakdawalla, and I think you can even search on Phoebe, she did a fabulous description, far better than I could do justice to. And so I highly recommend reading up on that.
Great. I'm a member of that, so I'll definitely check.
Oh, okay. She writes wonderful articles. So,
yes.
You know.
Okay. I haven't seen that one, so I'll definitely look
yeah,
that
it,
up.
It was a while ago, so you'll have to look back through the archives.
Great. All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So,
question.
Please go ahead.
Yeah, this is Earl Kyle, Solar System Ambassador, Rochester, Minnesota. My memory vaguely recalls that Cassini went through the plume once upon a time and detected organic molecules. Am I correct on that recollection or not?
We have gone through the plume a number of times, yes. And, very simple organics have been detected. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Like methane or what?
Yeah, and let's see. I have a list written down someplace. Okay, give me a second, and I'm going to see if I can find my list.
Well, I'm trying
simple,
to Google it
myself. They're organics. And they were detected by the ion-neutral mass spectrometer. And we have flown through the plume, I think a half a dozen times now, actually. Okay, Sean, you should talk while I'm trying to find my list.
Yeah, I was just thinking. I think I know that there's another passage through the plumes, or maybe getting my moons mixed up, but we will be flying through again. I'm pretty sure there will be more measurements of the plume composition from INMS in upcoming flybys.
Should be in late October.
Okay, making sure I wasn't confusing Dione and Enceladus.
And on page 16, Candy, you mentioned three of the MASS 28 candidates, two of which were carbon-based.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to think of things other than CO and CO2.
Well, you had ethylene, so.
But we didn't find that. So those are things we did not find. And right now I'm looking for what we did find.
Okay. I see what you mean. Okay. The difference between mass candidates and detections.
Right.
Yeah, so I think another interesting piece of the puzzle has to do with the vent velocity, and it all gets back to what you think is really going on, because in your modeling, Candy, you've assumed sort of a constant velocity at every occultation, at every point, and, you know, if you believe, I would think naively that the velocity, the plume velocity would be related to the width of the fracture at the time of eruption. Just, you know, if you just sort of want to go with Bernoulli there. And so that I think maybe throws another monkey wrench into the works. I'd be curious to see how that might fold in. But again, if the observations tell you that it really is flat, you know, you have to question your model for what's going on beneath the surface.
Yeah, and like I said, in those calculations, that's really probably the weakest link. But, you know, if I start varying the numbers, it's completely arbitrary, and that would not be good either. I can tell you that this is an active area of research, and in fact, I'm working with one of the guys on the INMS team to compare what we see with UVIS at about 15 to 20 kilometers altitude with what the ion neutral mass spectrometer sees at a higher altitude, and trying to come up with three-dimensional models. So it is an area we're actively working on.
Mm-hmm.
This is Earl Kyle again. I wanted to go back in your presentation to the width of these cracks in the tiger stripes.
Uh-huh.
Seems to me when it went by kind of fast, it was like on the order of 30 feet across. Am I right on that?
That's the actual opening. The actual opening. The fissures themselves are wider, but where we think the gas and particles are coming from is what I'm talking about.
Well, that still seems kind of big to me. I mean, is that sort of like the size of Old Faithful geysers size in Yellowstone Park? I've been there a couple of times, but I can't remember how big that was.
Well, 9 meters. Old Faithful is not 9 meters. It's a lot less.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Uh-huh. Well, so let me rephrase that. It's constrained to not larger than 9 meters. I guess they could be even smaller, but that would be below the resolution of the near-infrared spectrometer.
Yeah, in a lot of cases with these measurements, you can sort of say that they are constrained to be not bigger than a certain dimension.
Well, Sears did a measurement where they did super resolution work with the FP3 sensor so that they could get their resolution down to fractions of the size of the pixels in the FP3 detector. And I think it was the Sears measurements of the thermal sources in the fissures that led to that 9-meter restriction.
Hmm. Yeah, and I know they're still looking at those observations. I didn't realize that that had come from Sears.
Yeah, that's a Spencer observation.
Yeah, I remember it well.
Okay, and I have finally found my list here. So we've got CH3OH. We've got C2H4O. We've got C2H6O, HCN, and CH4.
Hmm. Interesting.
And CO2. So if you look for papers authored by Waite, W-A-I-T-E, Hunter Waite, although, sorry, it's not going to be H, it's going to be J.H.Waite. Those are the ion neutral mass spectrometer papers that give the composition.
Thanks.
Uh-huh.
In fact, there's your evidence for CO2 in the system.
Yeah.
Right there.
Right.
So just for fun, I mean, if you put this 200 kilograms per second into a year, that's 6.3 times 10 to the ninth kilograms that Enceladus is losing. And we've seen this for at least 50 years, if not longer. What's the fate of Enceladus?
Oh, you know, that was another speaking of, that was one that occurred to us almost, you know, within a day or so. So if you even multiply by 4.9 billion years, what you find out is that Enceladus will have lost a shell of itself 3 kilometers in radius.
Okay. I was about to plug it into the mass, plug in and get the mass of Enceladus and go it that way. Okay, thank you much. Cool. That's kind of bugged me as we've gone through this. Thank you.
Yeah, we were all worried for quite a while, or at least a day, until somebody on the UVIS team figured it out.
Obviously, Larry.
What was that number again? So if you went 4 billion years, it would lose how much?
3 kilometers. A shell, 3 kilometers.
Okay.
So instead of being 252 kilometers in radius, it used to be 255 or something like that.
Okay.
Hmm. Okay, and do we have anyone else with any other questions out there?
Very good talk. One of the best I've heard. Thank you.
I would agree. Okay, so if we are done with our questions, I will... We'd like to thank our speaker once again for an excellent talk. Thank you, everyone, for attending this edition of the Charm Telecons. The audio file will be available within a few days, and I would like to invite you all to please keep your ears open for the next Charm Telecon, which should take place at the end of April. So, Candy, thank you once again, and I hope everyone has a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you. It was great.
Thank you. Thank you very much. This is Cliff DeLacy again. I thought it was a wonderful presentation.
Thank you. Bye.
Okay. Bye.